from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In his new book, A Fool's Errand, historian Lonnie Bunch recounts how he took the National Museum of African American History and Culture from an idea to a reality. The museum, which in his words, recenters African American history and culture as keys to understanding who we are as Americans, has now welcomed more than 6 million visitors since its opening in 2016, and it holds treasures such as the shawl worn by Harriet Tubman and the red convertible driven by Chuck Berry. And last June, Lonnie Bunch was appointed secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. He joins us now to talk about the museum's founding, what he calls his life's grandest challenge, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Delighted to have you here, and this is quite a story. I mean, it's a story for you that is an 11-year sojourn and something that you felt you needed to resist and were fearful of, and you tell the whole story, but it's really a story that goes back about a century.
It's been a 100-year journey since people really wanted to craft a museum that helped people understand the African-American experience. It goes back to Civil War veterans who basically, when the 50th anniversary of the Civil War occurred, you know, old Yankees and old rebels shook hands, but nobody black was involved. And suddenly they said, what about us? And that began this journey, and that made me say, I want to fulfill their dreams to commit and fulfill this century-long struggle.
Well, your inspiration also comes from your own family. I mean, you make that very clear in your book. Your grandfather was a sharecropper. Your father was someone who suffered a great deal of discrimination, as almost anybody African-American did during that period. And this was for the ancestors.
That's absolutely right. I never thought about even ancestors or even my own family till I started doing this. And I kept thinking about my grandfather being a sharecropper, taking 10 years to go through college and train, and basically his efforts transforming my family. I thought of my family, my father's struggle, and I realized that what I wanted to do was make sure this museum told the story of people who were famous only to their family.
But also tell the story of what has too often been called that peculiar institution. You really wanted people to know what slavery was.
When I did a lot of surveys, the number one thing people wanted to know about was slavery. The number one thing they didn't want to know about was slavery. So I realized that to help Americans understand how we're all shaped, not just by those who are held enslaved, and I wanted people to understand that slavery still has a resonance on us today. And that's why I decided to really focus a lot of time on slavery so that you understand this is not something to be embarrassed about. It's something to say, if you're African-American, I wish you were as strong as your enslaved ancestors.
So let me take you, as you take us in your book, and this is a great deal of the museum, which, by the way, I saw when I was in D.C., and it was nothing short of spectacular. I have a little story I promised I would tell. But before I get to that, there is just so much to see in that museum. And you take us to September 24th, 2016, the opening, and your heart was probably beating very fast then because there were tens of thousands of people at the opening. It was on the Mall, which is where you felt it really needed to be. And there was, former President Bush and his wife, the Obamas, President Clinton, Chief Justice John Roberts, John Lewis. I mean, it was an extraordinary packed of every VIP you could possibly think of. And you had to address all those people. Give us that moment.
I was terrified, you know, because the reality is it was almost harder to plan the opening than actually build the museum. Who gets to speak? Who's on the stage? So I'm sitting next to John Lewis, and he gives his speech, and then he relaxes. He sits down, but he blocks my path. So when they call my name, I'm like, I am going to trip and fall. So that's all Barry's going to remember is that I'm going to trip and fall. I climb over John Lewis, and suddenly I walk past the Obamas, the Bushes, and I see the crowd, and I almost stop. I'm so scared. And then I heard people calling out my name, saying Lonnie Bunch. And I realized that at that moment, they were calling out my grandfather, who was Lonnie Bunch, my father, who was Lonnie Bunch. And I suddenly realized that I was standing on their shoulders and that I was celebrating them, so I should be able to go forward and give this little speech.
And now you're Secretary of the Smithsonians. I mean, you've risen through the ranks. Did you ever think that would be the case? Ever even imagine it?
People tell me that I always wanted to be secretary. No, I didn't. I just wanted to be a good historian, and building the museum was, I thought, my legacy and as far as I was going to go. But I realized that building the museum gave me everything I need, a legacy, visibility. Being Secretary of the Smithsonian is my chance to give back to the Smithsonian. There's nothing I get out of this, not a thing. But what it is a chance to say, here's the place that hired me when I was 26 years old and didn't know anything. Here's the place that allowed me to learn how to become a curator. Here's the place that gave me not just a job, but a calling. So this is an opportunity to help the Smithsonian become that 21st century institution that America needs and America deserves.
But what a job. I mean, thinking about not only the National Zoo, but you got 19 museums. And back in 2018, there were 29 million visitors to the museum. We're talking to Lonnie Bunch. He's Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and his new book is called A Fool's Errand, Creating the National Museum of African American History and Culture in the Age of Bush, Obama, and Trump. Let's talk about the title of your book, by the way. It goes back to, actually 19th century.
That's right. There's a 19th century novel called A Fool's Errand, written by Albion Tourget, who's somebody who went into the South after the Civil War to sort of bring the races together to uplift the country, and he failed. And he wrote this book, and he basically said that A Fool's Errand, even if it fails, if it somehow helps make a country better, then it's all worth the effort. And so I kept thinking as I was doing this, because what happened is when I was leaving Chicago to come back to the Smithsonian, one of the people that I knew very closely said to me, "What are you, a fool? Why would you take this job?" He said, "You want to be the second director of the museum because the first one will fall on his face." So I kept that notion of a fool and a fool's errand, and I thought that's really what this was.
Well, I think there are many people who would dispute the notion of you being a fool or foolish. And let me open up the phone lines. Many of you may have actually been to the Smithsonian institutions of one sort or another, but particularly we're focusing on the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And Lonnie Bunch is with us talking about his book, A Fool's Errand, Creating the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Have you been to the African American Diaspora Museum here in San Francisco?
I've been to just about every museum around.
I would have figured, but our former colleague, Belva Davis, was really singularly responsible for that.
Absolutely. And it's one of the most important museums because it forces us to think more broadly and help us understand that we're connected globally.
And your background, I mean, let me give out the number because I know there are people who would like to join us who have questions for you and comments. But I want to talk about Emmett Till because there was some legislation just passed on making lynching a national hate crime, which it's taken about a century to do, too. And I know you had contact with Emmett Till's. Mm-hmm. It's a very moving story with his mother and got actually something for the museum on that score. But let me invite listeners to join the program. You can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. And that number again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email any questions or comments you might have for our guest to forum@kqed.org. I promised a little story before, and I'll make it short and cogent. I went to the museum, and it was early on, and I didn't have a ticket. And it was a hot ticket then. And I'm in line. I'm thinking, how can I get a ticket? And there was a young African-American, well, young girl, teenager, really, with a number of other African-American teenagers standing in front of me. And I happened to notice that this one teenager was wearing a T-shirt with a picture of Rosa Parks. And I said, "Oh, Rosa Parks." I said, "This may sound unbelievable to you, but I actually interviewed her. I've been in broadcasting that long, and so forth." And she said, "Really?" And tell me, and let's talk about it. And we talked a little. Anyway, the long and short of it was, I said something about, "I don't know how I'm going to get a ticket. I'm in line here, but I'm going to try to get a ticket." She said, "I have an extra ticket. Here, take it." It was just really a sweet moment, you know, and an unexpected moment.
And that sense of community and family is what we wanted to create. And I love that. I've heard that story over and over again, that somebody said, "Here, join me." And that's what I love about it, that it's a place that even if it tells the unvarnished truth, it's a story that brings people together.
Well, let's talk about Emmett Till for the moment, because I know you were very moved by that experience you had with his mother, and there's now federal legislation, again, over a century, that lynching is a federal crime now.
It's about
a hate crime.
It's about time, because for me, when I was president of the Chicago Historical Society, one of my dear friends was Studs Terkel, the great oral historian.
Well, I also interviewed. I go back that long. Yeah.
Studs was great. And Studs would always say to me, "Lonnie, here's who you should meet." And he said, "Don't you want to meet Emmett Till's mother?" And I didn't know she was still alive. So he brought her into my office. We were supposed to have an hour lunch. And this tiny but powerful woman sat down and spoke for 7 hours, told me everything that happened from the time she kissed her son goodbye to the time she buried her son, who was murdered in 1955.
Yeah, we should, because there are a lot of young listeners who are not historically aware of even that infamous case. It came – it was a boy out of Chicago who went to Mississippi. He was a 14-year-old kid.
To visit family and ran afoul of the system. Supposedly, he went into a store and whistled at a woman, a white woman. 2 days later, her family came after him, took him out of the bed, destroyed him, brutalized his body. The governor of Mississippi didn't want to let the body come home. Emmett Till's mother demanded, "I want my son." They brought the body back, and it was wrapped in boxes with chains. And a letter said, "You cannot open this." And she said, "You will open this so I can see my son." And she told me how painful it was to see her son that way. But then she realized that her son's death would be in vain if it didn't reinvigorate the civil rights movement. So at the funeral, she demanded an open casket. It was one of the most horrible images you could imagine because she said, "The world needs to see what they did to my son." And the courage of that woman to open that casket, to basically say, at the worst moment of her life, she was going to turn evil into good. And I think that she became a teacher and taught kids on the South Side of Chicago for 20 years. And she just motivated me. And she said to me, I was at her house one day and she said, "Lonnie, you know, I've carried the burden of Emmett Till for 50 years. It's your turn." And so she died shortly after I came back. And there was this moment where the original casket of Emmett Till was discovered because he had been disinterred to be in, by the FBI. The old casket was supposed to be kept in a pristine condition. It was thrown in a shed. Raccoons were living in it. And the family called me and said, "Could you do something?" And I remember thinking, should I take a casket? But then I kept remembering Mamie Mobley saying, "It's your turn. Don't let people forget Emmett." So we decided to do an exhibition that's become one of the most sacred places in the museum, not so much about the broken body, but about the mother's courage of keeping that casket open. And to me, it's the place when we were getting ready to open the museum, whenever I was nervous, I would go there and just feel the power of Mamie Mobley.
That's an inspiring and poignant story. And we should mention that the woman who charged him with whistling actually recanted many years later.
Finally.
Yeah. Well, let's go to our callers, and let's begin with you, Gwen. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I want to thank you for that museum. I tried to go 2 years ago, and there was a line. But one suggestion for people that want to go, contact your state senator, and they can get you tickets. I would like to also to say, people don't know, but George Bush was the one that actually put the funding in to get that started. So I just wanted to make that point.
I think it's important to realize that President Bush cared a lot about this. He signed the legislation. He didn't necessarily put all the funding in. That would have made my life a little easier.
You did a lot of fundraising.
A lot of fundraising. But what he did, which was so important, is there were many people who felt the museum shouldn't be on the mall. And he came out very strongly and said, "Of course it's on the mall." And when the president of the United States says that, I use that every time I could. It's got to be on the mall. The president said so.
Let me thank Gwen for her call and go right to another caller. That's Eileen in Palo Alto. Good morning.
Yes, I went to the museum last spring, and it was a profound experience to walk through there. And one of the most delightful exhibits for me was the photographs from Greenville, Mississippi, which is where I grew up.
Ah.
I'm curious to know the backstory of how you got all of those photos.
We had decided that one of the things we wanted to do was tell intimate stories of little communities or regions. And so we were doing research in Mississippi, and we stumbled upon a photographer, a black photographer, who had hundreds of images that he had taken in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And his family said, "Is this anything that interests you?" And we were so moved by that, we said, "Well, let's tell the whole story of Greenville through the images of this person." So part of it was my staff doing brilliant work, researching and finding people, and some of it is just luck.
Talk about your staff. I mean, when this idea started to even move forward, you didn't have any staff.
I started with a staff of two, counting me. We had no collections, no money, no idea where the museum would be. We just had a dream.
It's an amazing story. I mean, just to bring it to fruition, and I'm thinking also about that day that I summoned back to your memory, which will stay in your memory the rest of your life, no doubt, on September 24th, 2016. Patti LaBelle was there singing a song which you selected, the famous Sam Cooke song.
I think the Sam Cooke song, A Change Is Gonna Come, is both an anthem to the civil rights movement, but an anthem that we as a country have to continue to prod and push to make this country live up to its stated ideals. And when Patti LaBelle sang that song, I started crying.
Of course, the irony is the change that was going to come was mentioned to be Hillary Clinton. 2 weeks later, we had Trump.
That's right. It was not the change President Clinton thought was going to happen.
Although President Clinton jumped up when somebody said that, right?
He jumped up, and because at the end of her song, Patti LaBelle said, a change is going to come, and she yelled out, Hillary. And he jumped up and said, that's right. Well, that was wrong.
Again, we're talking with Lonnie Bunch, who is Secretary of Smithsonian and founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and who's the author of A Fool's Errand, Creating the National Museum of African American History and Culture in the Age of Bush, Obama, and Trump. You know, in reading your book, I was struck by the links to both North Carolina and South Carolina. In fact, interested in your thoughts about the, well, South Carolina now. We don't want to get necessarily too political here, but Tom Steyer stood up and said, I'm the only candidate here who's in favor of reparations. And when you look at slavery and when you think about slavery, regardless of where you stand, you have to think about the question of reparations. How does that tie in with your vision?
For me, I'm not really interested in saying we need to give African Americans X amount of money. What I'm interested in is people putting money to education. My concern is that African Americans like me got in under a window. We got through based on fellowships and grants and special opportunities. I worry that so many other kids now don't have that opportunity. So for me, reparations would be make a fairer educational system that would encourage, that would enable more kids to fulfill their own dreams.
What do you say when people ask you, how do we reckon with slavery? I mean, how do we reckon with it, particularly in light of the fact that it is, in many people's minds, America's original sin?
I think part of the ways that reckoning is to actually talk about it, to understand it. One of the things we wanted in the museum was to realize so many people had different notions about what slavery was. I had many African Americans. I remember one day I was walking down the street and an elderly African American woman said, I know who you are. You're working on that museum. Can I hug you? And she hugs me and then she whispers in my ear, but don't talk about slavery. So I really wanted to make sure that you can't find reconciliation and healing if you don't find the truth. And so that's what really shaped me, the way we worked on slavery.
So let's talk about what we talk about when we talk about slavery, to borrow from Raymond Carver. Mm-hmm. I mean, what did you want to do and what did you realize in terms of the vision that you put into the museum? What's there? I mean, there are people who have never been there, don't even know what's there.
Well, there were three things that we wanted to do. One is we wanted to reposition slavery not just as a black story, but as a story that shaped the country. Most of us learned our colonial history through the Pilgrims and the Puritans and the like. Well, what we said is the way to understand the creation of this country is to see the role that slavery played in the North, in South Carolina, throughout the country. So we wanted people to realize that slavery was not only something that shaped a community, it was the economic foundation of a country.
Here's a listener named AJ who writes, I'm a white male, 100% Italian descent. I consider myself Italian-American. My grandparents on both sides were forced to flee Italy because they were very vocal in their opposition to Mussolini and his fascist regime. As someone with this background, whose family emigrated in the 1930s and never owned slaves or knew of anyone who owned slaves, where do I fit in with America's history and relationship to slavery?
You fit in with the broader story of the African-American experience. First of all, the economic opportunities all of us have were based on slavery. So regardless of when you came, where your family came from, but also notions of redefining citizenship, as shaped by the African-American community that made us embrace more of the immigrant community, our notions of the sense of education and how central education is, so that in essence, even if you were born in Italy and had just gotten here 20 minutes ago, you're still profoundly shaped, benefiting from being informed by the African-American experience.
They used to use the word Negro many, many years ago. It's been pretty much effaced, but I remember a comment of Richard Wright's. He said, the Negro is America's metaphor.
Metaphor, absolutely. That's what I think. I think it's – and what we did is we decided not to build a museum about black people for black people. We said this is a museum about America that uses the African-American experience as a lens to better understand who we are. And that, to me, was what's so important about what we did.
But there's also so much more in the museum. I mean, slavery is really the center of so much of the experience you have in that museum. It's something you walk out and you really have to process and sort through, and it stayed with me even to the present day. But you got a lot of popular culture and the amazing contributions of African-Americans in just about every field imaginable.
Exactly. We have an entire floor on culture that talks about everything from sort of the creativity and the fine arts to the impact of African-Americans on theater, film, and television, but also then music, the kind of amazing array that takes you from gospel to hip-hop, that really gives you the whole sweep of the African-American musical experience. And so in a way, what we're really saying is this is your culture too.
And as I said in the introduction, you even have the shawl of Harriet Tubman. Famous film just came out about Harriet Tubman, got a lot of attention at the Oscars this year. Where'd you get that?
What I love is that we found 40,000 artifacts, of which 70% were in basements, trunks, and attics of people's homes. And one day I got a call from a collector who said he had material from Harriet Tubman. And I'm a 19th century historian, so I said, no, you don't. That's just impossible. And he said, well, look, come to Philadelphia and I'll show you. And this guy was really big, 6'3", a big man. And he came out with a tiny little box and he pulled out pictures of Harriet Tubman's funeral that few had ever seen. And I said, oh, my goodness. And when I said that, he punched me because he was so excited and it hurt. He was a big guy. And he pulled out 32 items. And every time he pulled one out, he punched me. And then he pulled out the shawl that there's a picture of Harriet Tubman 3 days before she died wrapped in that shawl. And there it was in front of me and I'm crying. But of course, partly because I realized –
partly from the punches maybe?
Partly from the pain and partly from I realized I couldn't afford to buy this stuff. What am I going to do? And so I danced around for a while and I said to this collector, I said, what's it going to take for this to come to the Smithsonian? And he said, shake my hand. And that's what really moved me, the generosity of the American public trusting us with their stories, their history, their artifacts is what made the museum successful.
And you wanted, I believe, the guitar of Chuck Berry's where he actually wrote the song Maybelline, the lyrics to Maybelline. Talk about the deal he made with you.
So Chuck Berry said to me, you want the guitar? Well, I'll tell you what, you got to take my car. I said, your car? He said, yes, I've got a 1972 Candy Apple Red Cadillac. You got to take that as well. And I said, I don't want this car. And luckily, I have staff that's much smarter than I am. And they said, oh, no, the car is really important to Chuck Berry. It's a symbol of his prosperity. So we basically cut the deal and said, all right, we'll take the guitar and the car, but I never planned to display the car. I wasn't interested, but my staff kept saying, no, you've got to do this. And now that car is one of the most photographed artifacts in the entire museum. Shows how smart I am.
Tell you a story later off air about Chuck Berry, but let me go to another caller. We got Andrew coming on next. Andrew, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm looking forward to visiting the museum. I'm sorry I haven't been able to visit it yet. But I had a question because I grew up white in the South in the 50s and 60s. I read a book recently that, frankly, has changed my life. It is by Susan Neiman called Learning from the Germans, Race and Memory of Evil. And she compares the way America has processed its legacy of slavery and Jim Crow to the way Germany has processed and dealt with its Nazi legacy. A very powerful chapter on Emmett Till, and really applying a philosophical method to lived experience in modern and recent history to address the question of how does a people address the fact that its parents, grandparents, great-grandparents committed acts of great evil. I'm wondering if you happen to be familiar with the book, and if so, if you have found it useful as a tool for analysis of a lot of these powerful issues.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful book. And what I did was I spent a lot of time traveling the world looking at how Germans wrestled with their past, looking at how Australians wrestled with their relationship with Aboriginal people, a lot of time in South Africa looking at reconciliation and racial healing. So all of that shaped what we did, which was to say we had to illuminate all the dark corners, not to find guilt, not to point fingers, but to find healing and reconciliation, and to help Americans realize that they don't understand fully who they are if they don't understand and embrace all these histories.
We just had Alexis Coe on recently, who has a new biography of George Washington, and she makes the argument that this story that is often associated with Washington, it's one of redemption where slavery is concerned, but it is ill-deserved because he really only one slave who fought by his side in the Revolutionary War out of over 100 was freed by him, and Martha didn't free any of them until she sort of became afraid they were going to burn the house down and all that. So, I mean, this is a legacy that you as a historian have constantly been confronted with. How do you separate the wheat from the chaff, particularly the myth from the reality?
Well, I think that's really the key. I mean, that's what a good historian does, right? To try to sort of separate the myth from reality. And one of the things that was really important to me was for many African Americans, slavery was an embarrassment. So you have a lot of people who say, let's look back to Africa. Let's look back that we were all kings and queens in Africa. That's not true. But I thought what's more important is I don't want people to forget their African roots. But my goodness, they're forgetting 200 and 300 years of their African American roots. And so I really want people to understand that you can't be who you are without looking back at that history of that community.
Let me get Vikram on next. Vikram, you're on. Morning.
Hi, thank you. I had a question regarding religion. I kind of feel that, and please you correct me if I'm wrong, but part of the root of the problem was that Christianity and religions in general were forced on African-American society, even other societies, to be quite honest, and that part of that indoctrination led to all of this, and why Christianity, for example, is still prevalent in their societies when it's not something they adopted of their own accord and might have led to the plight in the first place.
Well, I'm not sure Christianity led to the plight. It was one of the factors they used to justify it.
Curse of Ham.
That's right, exactly, to argue that these are people that are marked and therefore they're fundamentally different. What it's clear that slave owners used religion and Christianity as a way to say, you know, slave, obey thy master, trying to control them. But what I think is so powerful is how African Americans took that Christianity and made it theirs. Suddenly the story of the Israelites are the story of African Americans crossing the River Jordan for freedom. So that in a way, the Bible is, and Christianity is a two-sided sword. It was used to restrict, but it was also used to give power for a community.
Well, it's been a treat to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us. In fact, I want to read a comment from a listener who says, I'm so moved listening to your stories, Lonnie Bunch. You've given such a profound gift to this country, to all people. If they embrace it, for those of us that only dream of doing something great with their lives, you have achieved it.
Oh, thank you. I'm touched.
I'm touched by your stories and your book. And the book, again, I really certainly recommend to listeners. It's called The Fool's Errand, Creating the National Museum of African American History and Culture in the Age of Bush, Obama, and Trump. More Forum ahead. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.